Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Russ Terry, founder and CEO of Life Coach Radio Networks. Today's sponsor is Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free audiobook when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/lifecoachradio. That's audibletrial.com/lifecoachradio. And now, here's today's show.
Hello, 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 everybody, and welcome to Lifelines with Wendell Buckner. Today's show, we're going to talk quite a bit about the science of coaching. With me, I have a guest of mine who's also a friend of mine. We've gone through coach training together, and even to this day, still correspond and share ideas about coaching, life, and learning. His name is Eric Reeves. He's an executive coach and senior manager with Lockheed Martin. And beyond his distinguished military career, he's also devoted himself to the pursuit of knowledge in the areas of physiological psychology, experimental psychology, psychology of personality, and even psychology of learning. So we're glad to have him with us. Eric Reeves, welcome, and thank you for joining me.
Well, thanks, Wendell. I appreciate you asking me to be on this, and I'm really excited to talk about this. It provided me the opportunity to do a blatant plug. I'd like to provide anybody who's listening, if you're interested in contacting me on any of this information, the email address that's most convenient is eric.n.reeves@gmail.com. And I'll repeat that again at the end.
All right, great. Well, I'm really glad to have you on the line with us. And for anyone who's listening via the internet, I would encourage you certainly to become a part of the conversation. The guest call-in number is 646-716-9397. Again, that number is 646-716-9397. I welcome your active participation. I'd be glad to put you on and have you share a comment with us or ask a question of us. So at any time, feel free to join us at 646-716-9397. So, Eric, I wanted to start off with just a little bit of conversation based on your breadth of knowledge as it relates to the science of coaching. I know that we talk from time to time about one of our favorite authors, David Rock, and he has an organization that is called Neuro Leadership that focuses on neuroscience and focuses on the brain's activity as a part of our overall coaching engagement. How would you describe David Rock and his writing, especially as it pertains to the concept and the reality, I should say, of neuroscience in that particular field of study?
Well, I think a lot of people, David Rock in particular, but even folks like Dan Goleman and Richard Davidson and other writers, they've made it a lot more accessible. There's a lot of things that have been written about neuroscience and neuroscience of education and coaching, but it can be very academic, and they've really made it accessible to a more general audience. They've also brought it down to areas that we are specifically interested in terms of leadership and coaching, and it's something that's useful. It's something that helps us help our clients a lot more. And I think that they've just done a tremendous service for us. I think the biggest factor that has helped them is the fact that the whole idea of the functional MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, has really only been around for since about the early 90s. And what the functional, or the fMRI has done is it allows researchers to actually see what's happening in the brain when certain activities are taking place. So if you're familiar with an MRI where it shows you what the brain looks like, the functional MRI will actually see what's happening in the brain when different things are presented to an individual. So whether it's faces of anger or images of happiness, the brain will respond in certain ways until we can actually see what's taking place. And this has really been a big change for us in being able to take these ideas and bring them back into the context of the coaching. And that's exactly what...
Right, the functional MRI and neuroscience in general, as I understand it, neuroscience is still a relatively new and constantly changing field of study. And we've had great progress in the past, even just 50 years, in terms of how the brain actually works as it relates to habit formation. And I find that a lot of that is based on some of the habits that we as a society have, be it, you know, alcoholism or smoking cessation. But certainly, once those components have been identified that lead to some more negative habits, we can certainly use that same information to help develop new habits that are more beneficial to our lifestyle. So tell us a little bit more about habits and what happens to the brain as it relates to habits.
Well, and this is where I think that as a coach, the more we understand even just the fundamental aspects of neuroscience, which is which part of the brains are operating and the function of the neurotransmitter, you know, these processes that are carrying these chemicals through our brain to different centers, by us knowing that, it helps us to put a little better spin on what we've basically been taught as a cognitive process. So, you know, us asking questions of our client, us pausing to allow them time to reflect. You know, there are things that are taking place in the brain that if we understand that, we can, even if we don't bring it to the surface, it kind of underlies what's happening inside the client's brain, and which is basically what we're doing. And there's a lot of relationship between what we do as a coach and what an educator would do or what a psychotherapist would do. We just have that understanding now so we can better bring service to our clients. But you mentioned an interesting thing with habits and things like smoking and other what we would call bad habits. And a lot of that has to do with the neurotransmitters. You know, our health, the things we do on a daily basis, whether it's stress or lack of sleep or caffeine or what have you. And I'm certainly not condemning anybody for doing that. I run on Dunkin' myself. But that impacts the neurotransmitter. And so even us being able to explain to our client what's happening, if you have a bad day, you can recognize that it's a chemical process. It's a biochemical process that takes place. And what we try to do in coaching is help our client understand that. And then the process of creating new habits is really creating new pathways in the brain, propel them forward to whatever goals they want to achieve.
Okay.
I hope that answered your question there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and of course, it brings out another one. So talk a little bit in the, you know, as a 101 professor about neurotransmitters and the pathways that our brain actually does create.
Well, when you think about the things we've learned, I mean, and we talk about this, you know, with our clients, and that's the primary function of us when we go into coaching is we explain to our clients how it works. You know, their outlook on life is really shaped by the things they've experienced, the way they've been brought up, to some degree genetics and heredity. That's going to determine a certain way that chemicals are being released and the way the processing takes place. But we can then take those ideas and we can say, okay, well, here's what's happening. Now let's create these new patterns. One of the most interesting things that came across to me was even the fact of memory, that memory is this biochemical process. And we sometimes, and a lot of us have had this experience, I'm sure most of your listeners have had this experience where you've done something, you've been someplace, and it's such a wonderful experience, and when you go back later, it's just not the same. Well, it's not, because every time you've recalled it, your brain has changed that memory. It's created it to be better. You know, the brain takes these stored images, it reconstructs them, it brings them forward so you can process, and then when it puts them back into place, it deconstructs the stores. So it changes every time you think about it. Okay, so that's on the positive side. Now think about a traumatic experience. When somebody experiences something traumatic, it can be the same thing. They bring it forward, they create this horrible image around it, and downplaying the fact that people have bad experiences, but it's changing every time. So that's where in coaching, where we use the idea of reframing. Okay, and at the cognitive level, we say, well, let's think about something positive that came out of this bad experience. At the neuroscience level, what's actually happening is you are restructuring that memory to be more positive as opposed to being negative. So again, once we understand what's happening in the brain level, it helps us to facilitate our actual coaching practice much better, I believe.
Yeah, and I definitely agree with you. I do find it very interesting as we look at the neuroscience, from a neuroscience perspective, the things that go on that we constantly take for granted, and yet, historically speaking, that we ourselves have experienced. The idea, that it's never as good as the first time. Everybody, like you said, that resonates with everybody. Everybody has something in which they've had that experience. So the ability to use understanding of neuroscience to help us with the more cognitive aspects of how we do coaching is very significant, both in how effective our coaching is and in terms of how our coaching is received by the client. So yeah, I think that's very interesting. Charles Duhigg wrote a book called The Power of Habit. And in that book, he talks about some of the components of habit in terms of our cues and our triggers and our rewards, and how we can not necessarily have the need to change all three of those, but to change one or two out of that sequence so as to move to more positive action from what may have initially been a habit that wasn't serving as well. So I certainly understand that it's very, very significant, like we've talked about, to how coaching is performed once we know what is really what the brain is doing with the words that we say.
Absolutely, and that's. And there's a couple things at play here. One is the neurotransmitters themselves. So we kind of have two big categories. We have inhibitory and we have excitatory. So, you know, we've all heard of serotonin and dopamine and norepinephrine and epinephrine. So serotonin is very much inhibitory. So it does not stimulate the brain. It kind of brings it down. It helps to stabilize mood. Dopamine actually can play a role in both. It's our main focus neurotransmitter, so it allows us to focus on things, focus issues. Epinephrine is another excitatory neurotransmitter. So, you know, we often talk in coaching how we have this idea of thoughts lead to emotion, lead to actions. Well, when you have a thought, and you think about this from Psych 101, you know, when you can generate, or even being on the highway, you know, driving on 95 in the morning, that's my, you know, that's the killer for me. You know, people cut you off and you get this reaction, you know, this anger reaction, let's say at the lowest level. Well, that's a neurotransmitter that's being released, you know, which is going to a certain part of your brain, which is then causing you to have these feelings. It's this reaction. So as we start to train ourselves that, you know, the matter of perspective, let's think about it differently. And by thinking about things differently, we have a different neurotransmitter release. We reduce the amount of anger we have over the same type of issues. That doesn't happen overnight because, again, we created these patterns through years and years of practice. So over time, we can then, you know, reflect. Critical reflection is such an important piece to think about. Why am I reacting this way? And then to say there's really no reason for it. And so we actually can coach ourselves to better behavior. And, you know, for our clients, that's part of our role, I believe, is to help teach them how to be self-regulating so they don't rely on us as coaches. I think that's a big piece of the role of what we do, a big piece of our benefit to them. So, you know, that's kind of the neurotransmitter piece. The other piece is the actual parts of the brain that are in action during the different parts of coaching. So when we're seeing something, we're bringing in sensory information, the activity is taking place in the back of the brain, that occipital lobe. And then as we start to reflect and integrate that with our current thoughts and our current memories, it shifts to those temporal lobes, the side there. And then when we start to hypothesize or manipulate that information in working memory to create new relationships and new meaning, it moves to that prefrontal cortex. And finally, when we go out to apply it, it shifts to the parietal lobe, top part of the brain. And not wanting to get too much into the weeds, but when we coach, by being aware of that, that's where we ask our client the question, we allow them the time to reflect, we let them form the answer to their problem, and then we ask them to go out, or we encourage them to go out and take that action. So we've actually hit all four parts of the brain, which creates this multiplier effect. Time, that's where those new habit patterns are formed. And that's where we help hold our client accountable for the actions that they are choosing that will move them forward.
And that is why coaching works when done properly. When we allow our clients to come up with, to dig in and come up with their own ideas, that they are much more mentally and emotionally attached to. That's when, you know, the great work happens, and we do have the ability to work ourselves out of the position of the necessity for dependent care as a coach, because we've created a new level of awareness along with the neurotransmitters that allow this format or style of thinking to be much more familiar and much more standardized or essential to the being of our client.
Yes. We help them, and again, when we go through our coaching training, you know, we're told the process, but we're not always told this is how it's working underneath. This is the biochemical process. This is the mechanism that's taking place, that's working, that's operating in each of our clients to help create them with a more positive reality, the reality that they really, you know, want to have to be as full a person as they could possibly be. And going back to David Rock, I had the opportunity to see him last year at a conference here in D.C., and one of the things that he had pointed out in some of the research that they've done at the NeuroLeadership Institute is that when the coach understands even just the fundamentals of the neuroscience, and they explain to their client what's happening, increased potential for insight in your client. And that's what we're trying to help generate, is our client to get that insight as to what are the answers to the questions that they have. And so that really made me kind of a David Rock devotee and really kind of solidified the value of neuroscience. And I've just barely scratched the surface. I'm by no means an expert. But over the past, you know, year and a half or so, I've really kind of dug into it. And it's fascinating. You know, it's fascinating not just for what we can do as coaches, but, you know, as coaches, we should always be striving to improve ourselves. You know, I think that's what drives or brings some of us into coaching in the first place, is learning the mechanism to help others, but then helping ourselves so we can be of more value to the world.
Right. That learning piece is essential for those listening. Anyone who's considering developing a relationship with a coach, the learning aspect is you know, an integral component to the quality of your coach, and specifically to the quality of your engagement, because we as coaches have to constantly be seeking to better understand both ourselves and others to be able to continue to add value and to be able to shorten the time gap between identification and resolution of our clients' issues.
Yes.
So yeah, the education piece is certainly one that I know both you and I try to carry forward in our careers.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit. Oh, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, and that's something you and I have talked about in the past, is that, you know, when we really get into the study of coaching and, you know, do some of the research, that coaching does draw from so many different disciplines. you know, it does draw from educational research. It draws from psychotherapy. It draws from counseling. It can draw from management research. You know, when we talk about business and having that as a basis, it certainly makes sense that we should also be seeing what's happening with the research in those areas and bringing that into coaching. I think that's just what makes us better coaches and makes us more effective to our clients, because it does pull from education and it does pull from psychotherapy. And I think as coaching becomes, I think the ICF does a great job in being sort of a legitimizing body. I think as we continue to grow and mature, I think you'll see a lot more people as they recognize the value of coaching. I would say people that are going to counselors and psychotherapists now, I would say many of them really don't need that. They need coaches. Or let me rephrase that. That the purpose they're going to these other specialists well served by going to coaches.
Right, and that is something that's certainly so interesting when you consider, you know, just carry that thought further, the strong consideration of where the coaching industry and the coaching practice goes from here, as coaching becomes more and more mainstream and the value of it is able to be proven, again, through education, I think we bring ourselves into an area of play as it relates to personal and professional development based on not only the profession, but the professionals' growth in education in these areas. So, you know, as I've said to you personally, I'm certainly an admirer of yours as you've sought to engage in this pursuit. And I'm glad to have you on the line. Once again, anyone listening that might be interested in joining the conversation, the call-in number is 646-716-9397. 646-716-9397. Look, Eric, talk a little bit about how you are able to use all of the experience and all of the education that you have that you've developed over the course of time into your practice as an executive coach. Tell us a little bit about the environment and the people that you coach and are make yourself available to, and then a little bit about how you utilize your skill set to provide services to that individual.
Sure. I guess by way of background, it might help. I did have an undergraduate degree in psychology. I did some graduate work in counseling and human relations, and basically did my graduate work while I was in the military. So I had a 20-year military career. My focus or my specialty was in counterintelligence. And a lot of my job was, in addition to being in command position, so I had about 7 years of command time, and a lot of that was really more mentoring. Had I known more about coaching, I think I know I definitely would have applied more of the coaching methodology to the job. Familiar with mentoring, trying to groom, you know, the individuals that were working for me at the time. But then also my actual specialty in counterintelligence was to be running or handling human sources, so to collect information of security for U.S. resources around the world, wherever I happen to be stationed or deployed. So after a 20-year military career, entered the defense contracting industry as an instructor. I was actually planning to become an architect, and got a call from somebody I'd worked with on active duty, and he said, "How'd you like to come teach?" And so I taught at the Defense Intelligence Agency for 5 years, really learned about the teaching methodology. And I think what really made me an effective teacher there was that I really cared about my students. And we often hear this sort of phrase about educators. It's not to be the sage on the stage, but it's to be the guide on the side. And I think the educational research is showing that, you know, again, if all we're doing is lecturing, you know, I talked before about how the brain works. All this information is just coming in. And if we're not allowing our students time to reflect on it, to process it, to create new ideas, you know, individually, give them time to reflect in the classroom, to socialize with their other students in the classroom, we're not as effective as we could be. And so kind of coming up to the coaching piece, you know, having had that background in psychology, mentoring in the military, human sources, teaching, as I look back, I can kind of see, I can see how these different aspects of what I've done really kind of led into tools that I could use in my coaching toolkit. From a corporate perspective, I did have a job. I left the employer I was working with Lockheed Martin at the time, to another company, was a vice president of operations. So it really helped me to learn the vocabulary and the hiring and all these things that a company has to deal with. Point of that is, with coaching, we're often told that it doesn't matter what you coach, you know, we have the specialty to ask the question. It can be applied everywhere. But I think there is a benefit to understanding the issues that your clients are dealing with, and at least understanding the vocabulary. So I think, kind of leading up to your question, then in the corporate environment, dealing with executive coaching, you still have the bulk of an executive's issues, cases, life event. It is life coaching. But where it isn't, it's helped me to have that corporate background to be able to identify with, certainly not the level that they're at now, but understanding more or less the issues that they're contending with. And so that's how I've kind of applied all these things that I've done in the past to both that corporate side, but even other folks that I coach just on life coaching issues. You know, kind of that same sense that, you know, I really want them to find the answers. And to kind of segue into another area of research, Richard Boyatzis has done, out of Case Western Reserve, has done bit of research into coaching with compassion. Mm-hmm. And that by generating, you know, by having this true compassion for our clients, we actually activate our own parasympathetic nervous system. So we activate these positive mechanisms within ourselves. You know, we reduce stress within ourselves. We create these feelings of happiness within ourselves because we really want the best for our clients. So kind of a long roundabout story, but I just kind of pointing out those different things that you asked, you know, how did that lead me up and how do I deal with that today? And I think that's it.
Well, and you know, the background is certainly beneficial. It helps us understand really how a good coach develops, not only in terms of the experiences individually, but again, in the awareness that you've developed to be able to bring some of the tasks that you've performed previously into the realm of experience as it pertains to a coach. Certainly, we know lots of people who may or may not be perceived as good coaches based on their experience, but really it comes down to how they've been able to harness those experiences and what they've been able to learn from them that give them the ability to become excellent coaches and excellent beneficiaries of even their own coaching and working with clients, just as mm-hmm. you mentioned. One of the things that I love about coaching is the ability to ask questions. And certainly from your background, we talk about in coaching about asking empowering questions or asking open-ended questions at the very least.
What is some of the psychology around why questions, and specifically empowering, open-ended questions work so well as a coach? From a psychological standpoint, what is it about questions that allow us to be so much better for our clients and allow our clients to be so much better for themselves, as opposed to consulting, where where a person is just telling another what steps to take for some perceived or assumed outcome? Why is there so much value in asking questions?
That's a good question, Wendell, and it goes back to the creation of new habits. You know, when you think about why people come to us as coaches, a lot of times it is, you know, I'm just kind of stuck here based on my life. I want to do this thing. I'm not really sure how to go about it. And we are just inundated by information. So in many cases, it's just there's so much stuff coming in that our clients just really don't know how to process. And so the questioning piece is really to, you know, when they're in their heads, you know, you've got all this stuff going on, and I'm a big list maker. You know, I love, and you and I have talked about this too, David Allen, Getting Things Done. He's got this process of getting things done. And he just says, you know, do the data dump. Get everything out of your head. Write it down. Make notes. And spend as much time as you need to get everything out of your head that you have to do, you want to do. You know, all this stuff. Because then you get it out of your head, out of storage, and now you've got space where you can process. And so I think when we ask these questions of our clients, you know, they've got so much that the answers, and we always, you know, clients are smart. You know, they have the information. They just need to figure out what really resonates with them. Because for any question, any problem they have, there can be multiple answers. And any one of them could be the right answer. But we want them to choose the one that really resonates, that really, when they say, this is what I want to do, this is where I want to go, this is who I want to be, we want them to get that gut feeling like, that is the answer. You know, I had all this stuff, but when you ask it like that, and I look at it this way, that is really where I want to go. And so then we kind of work with them to kind of work through that process. The questions themselves, though, that they also become that as they're processing, right? You know, we often hear about this multitask. The brain can do multiple things, but it can't focus on more than one thing at a time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, the fact that we breathe, we're digesting, the brain is doing that. Okay, the brain is thinking. So we're doing multiple things. The brain is the different parts of the brain. But our focus, we're either looking at this or we're looking at that. And when we think that we're doing multiple things, we're actually just shifting our attention back and forth. And so we're never really fully focused on any one thing. So the empowering questions are really to help our clients focus, to focus on that thing. When we ask the question, the closed-ended question that's just a yes or no, we basically stop the thought process. You know, we don't give them the opportunity to really start moving all these cogs and wheels and, you know, releasing all these neurotransmitters in the brain to really come up with the answer this have on you in your life if you did it this way. You know, how would this move you forward? Even the why question. I've read a little bit in the research. Even the why question, we might want to use too much, might not want to use too much, because when we ask why, sometimes that can elicit more of a rationalization from our clients. So instead of saying, you know, why do you want to do this? They may start to rationalize the reason. Instead, if we say, you know, how would this move your life forward? It's the same type of question, but it's going to cause them to think about it in a different way. And so eventually we kind of elicit them and help them work through and really find the answer that they've had all along. But it's just the one that, like I said, really resonates with them.
And I like the fact that, you know, within asking questions, open-ended questions, we allow that piece that you just talked about, the self-discovery,
the ability to kind of get opportunity, to create opportunity, create that space, that safe space for our clients to find themselves, to find those answers. And then we have the ability to go in and develop further focus on the answers themselves by asking questions about the responses. You know, how did you come up with that? You know, how long have you felt that way? How long have you thought about that? Just to create more and greater clarity within the answer itself, so that then the client is even more motivated to pursue, you know, whatever that is, because it is entirely original and it is entirely theirs. Just by asking empowering questions, by asking the right questions. I like what you said earlier as well about the idea of multitasking and the futility of that effort within the human brain. So thanks
for
bringing
out
that forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we really do. You know, and when we ask these questions and we give our, and you know how awkward it can be too. You know, there's that nobody really likes the silence. But you know, when
right.
we ask a client a question and there's this long extended pause and you kind of want to feel it. You know, going through the coach training, we're told let them think, because what's happening is now that process is taking place in that temporal lobe. You know, they're reflecting. They're integrating that with information there and trying to see how it all fits. And then when we take that next step and say, well, you know, what types of steps would move you forward? So that now they're shifting from that temporal lobe to that prefrontal cortex. They're moving forward so they can now engage in this creation aspect. And it's the manipulation of the information in that working memory to create this new meaning and these new relationships. And then when we ask them for the action step, you know, what are you going to do this week to move yourself forward? You know, they're creating it. But now when they actually go out and do it, that active testing is taking place, you know, in those parietal lobes. And so, again, it's just understanding that when we ask these questions, when we pause for reflection, we follow up with the action step, and then we hold them accountable, we are engaging the full brain and helping them to really get that, you know, greater chance for retention and improvement and those new habits for being formed.
Right. We have the ability to allow the client to create as opposed to just recall. Teaching them, you know, giving them opportunity to think as opposed to just to respond or to reply is a moving position. I know I've experienced it with my clients. That's a moving position to accept that silence, you know, that we are so used to doing any and everything we can to avoid, to allow it and to encourage it. But, you know, there's no sense in answering if you're not there yet. I have found it very amazing to just experience that from both a client standpoint and from a coach's standpoint. You know, and I find it amazing as well that is the component, that creation piece that you mentioned in asking questions, is very difficult for individuals to do in and of themselves. It's very interesting to, even for myself as a coach, to try and self-coach in that discovery and in that desire for creativity. I almost really need to have a conversation. I need to hear someone ask me the question that I wouldn't ask myself, because inherently I don't ask myself questions that I don't have the answers to. That doesn't help me grow myself. That doesn't encourage me. But it has always been a great thing for me when I've had my coach ask me questions that have caused me to drive deeper than I would in and of myself. So I'm glad you brought that forward as well.
That is an excellent point, Wendell. I would like to share something if I could. For my doctoral program, I had an advanced research methods class, and it was the self-study of professional practice. And what I did was I actually was looking at kind of my own spiritual development. What I did is I actually looked at the critical incidents that occurred during that, you know, the last 50 years, and I provided those to a coach that we both know and had her ask me questions around those incidents. And what was fascinating was even though I knew my own story and I had identified this critical incident, for her to ask me the question and to coach me around that generated so much insight, you know, that I was just, I don't know why I was amazed, because I know coaching can be very powerful, but for me to know these things and to have written them down and to provide them to her to coach me, it was pretty amazing. And in fact, I'm writing a paper proposal to present that at a conference next year, because it was such a good experience, and I think it's something that every coach should try. You know, pick an area, pick, you know, we all use a wheel of life of some type, but pick some area mm-hmm. in your life and identify those critical incidents that have occurred. And then have somebody coach, have an experienced coach ask you about them so that you can really reflect and they can ask you these empowering questions that cause you to think about it in a different way. Because we all create our own narrative, and that was part of the key to it. I didn't want to just write the narrative, because I would have written it the same way, the patterns that I formed in my brain wouldn't have changed. But by having her coach me to think about it in a different way, it really was a pretty amazing experience.
Yeah, and think about, that leads me to think about all of the things that are still left on the table for me to learn, even from my past experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to kind of look back and dive into some of them and squeeze out some of the lessons still to be learned from those past experiences that certainly would benefit me moving forward in life. So yeah, certainly something to keep in mind for those who are interested in developing a coaching relationship. Once again, if you're interested in calling in, and we'd love to hear from you, you can use the phone number 646-716-9397. Again, 646-716-9397. I also want to take this opportunity to talk about tomorrow's show. Tomorrow at 3 p.m., Leanne's going to be on with Walk Your Talk with Leanne and her guest, Peter Shankman. Peter Shankman is known for founding an organization called Help a Reporter Out, which was designed and changed how journalists gathered news and how public relations were done. Leanne is a fellow coach on a Life Coach Radio Network. She's also a certified professional coach and an Energy Leadership Index master practitioner. So if you're interested, be sure to check out her show at 3 o'clock on the Life Talk Radio Network. Again, 646-716-9397. And this is Lifelines with Wendell Buckner. We're talking about the science of coaching with my friend Eric Reeves. Talk a little bit, if you can, about some of them, as we're dealing with a couple of things, we're bouncing in and out of different areas, I would say, of what we call the science of coaching. But talk a little bit about the role that emotional intelligence plays as it relates to psychology and coaching. I know that there are components of the brain that contribute to our feelings and our emotions, and certainly we all know how those areas of the brain contribute to the chemical releases that we receive throughout our bodies, as this unique and magnificent system attempts to support itself with, as you mentioned already, thoughts that lead to feelings to actions, but that there are thoughts that actually allow us to even to create and even inherently or accidentally control the release of chemicals in our bodies. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. And when you mention emotional intelligence, you know, of course, anybody that's read anything in the field, you know, the first thing you think about is Daniel Goleman. Although there
right.
are kind of, you know, other schools of thought when it comes to emotional intelligence, you know, his book about that back in 95 really brought it to people's attention. And as I mentioned earlier, I think a lot of the reason for that was because he did have his PhD from Harvard, but then he went to write for, I think, Psychology Today, and I think it was the New York Times, one of the big papers. So he learned how to convey information in an understandable fashion. So, which is certainly, you know, not to downplay the value of what he brought, but it's just to highlight why his approach and his explanation of it really sort of got people interested in the concept. But I would say probably, you know, without getting too much into the theoretical piece, probably a central theme that I've heard at a lot of conferences and a lot of coaches refer to is the fact that when the information comes in, you know, it passes through this, you know, this limbic system, and before it gets to that prefrontal cortex or that control center. And so we actually have an emotion about something before we can think logically about it. And mm-hmm. so when you get something that's highly charged, you get this thing that's referred to as this amygdala hijack. So it is, you know, that neurotransmitter, that those pathways, they never make it up to the part where you can think logically because you've got such an emotion around an issue. And
right.
so the idea of emotional
cognitive processing isn't taking place.
Exactly. And, you know, when you think about if you've ever been in a conversation or an argument or discussion with somebody and they're just not seeming rational, choosing to be, they physically can't be because of this mechanism in the brain, this biochemical process. So, you know, that should be the central theme of marriage counseling. You know, it's not that your husband's not logical. Or you know, when you start to have these conflicts, they simply cannot do it. They are physically incapable where they are now in that space. So what emotional intelligence does is, first of all, let me be aware. You know, it's the self-awareness piece. And then once I'm aware of how I'm thinking and why I'm responding, you know, then I can be aware of how this impacts others. So it's the self-awareness and then the social awareness and then the taking the positive action to change. So, you know, very much at the cognitive level, but that's that underlying mechanism that's occurring. Some other research, and I mentioned this earlier, I've recently been reading The Emotional Life of Your Brain by Richard Davidson. And his is really fascinating because he talks about six sort of key things, sort of the emotions that occur, but they all occur because of different sort of pathways and different firing in the brain. So he divides it down between resilience, social intuition, context sensitivity, self-awareness, outlook, and attention or focus. And each of these six things really in combination or by themselves make up all the emotional things that occur to us. And they're really, each of these is marked by the amount of firing or the amount of activation that's occurring in the different parts of the brain. So one that I was particularly interested in was, again, having been in the military, having deployed during the Iraq War, and being very aware of a lot of the PTSD issues that have occurred, the relationship between that phenomenon of PTSD and context sensitivity. And Richard Davidson talked about how the fact that what is occurring is that you have this low activity in the hippocampus. And so it's the inability to distinguish a familiar from an unfamiliar context. So if you're in combat and you hear loud noises and, you know, you see unfamiliar people, your response to that, you know, being cautious, ducking, diving for cover, that makes sense. It is contextually appropriate. But when you come back
based
to
on
the world,
level of detail that you're dealing with.
Exactly. I mean that, you know, if I'm over there in Iraq or Afghanistan and I hear bombs and bullets, I'm going to die for cover, you know, for the most part. That's appropriate. That's an appropriate response. When I come back to a generally safe environment and I hear a noise and I die for cover, it is not contextually appropriate for the most part, unless you're in, we're in Baltimore a couple weeks ago. Sorry, that too soon. So the idea is it's this processing in the brain that takes place. And again, if we understand that, then we can help clients do the appropriate exercises to help overcome that. Now, things like this, again, I think we're still to the point where issues like that should be referred to professionals, you know, to true counselors and to a psychotherapist. But the more we understand how the brain is working, when people are experiencing that to a lesser degree, if we as coaches understand, can help our clients take the appropriate steps and do the appropriate exercises, whether it's meditation, mindfulness, what have you, I think that's where, again, we can bring greater value to our clients.
And I want to talk a little bit, as you answered that question, you know, with a lot of added value, I wanted to talk a little bit about psychology and about the science and really the understanding of what goes on inside our brains as much as our minds intellectually. In helping us as it pertains to our sensitivity, even within mankind, as opposed to just from a coaching perspective. You know, for example, as you talked about context sensitivity, and we understand the work of the hippocampus, these are things that people typically don't understand, or worse than that, are totally ignorant of, but they are contributors to not only ourselves as individuals, but in how we relate to one another. The compassion or the indignation that we show towards one another, that is a direct reflection of our knowledge and really of our understanding of what people are all about, what makes us tick, what why we are the way we are. And as a coach, and as a learner, I constantly think about the value of the things that I learn and what I know to society at large, to the community at large. Coaching aside, we still have a lot of learning and a lot of growth that would contribute significantly to us being better people towards one another. If we would just take the time to develop ourselves in our understanding of one another. So I'm glad that you brought that to the front of my mind, and I was able to say that. You know, there are a lot of pieces to this amazing puzzle that we lose track of or lose sight of as we seek other things that keep us from being better people towards one another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you phrased it nicely there. To mind a simple phrase that makes so much sense is that everything you're talking about, it's very simple. It's just not very easy. You know, we know how to do it. It's just difficult. It's like, you know, being healthy, you know, losing weight. We get all these newfangled diets and pills and processes, but it's really very simple to be healthy. It's diet and exercise. It's choosing the right foods and doing the right exercise. Simple, but not easy for some folks. Kelly McGonigal, who's a professor, a PhD at one of the California universities, she spoke at a conference here a couple about mindfulness. And she said something I found very interesting. She said, if we are mindful, if we are living in the moment, we are always relatively happy. If we're not, And think about that. You know, if we're living in the moment, we are always relatively happy. If we're not stressing about the past, you know, thinking about the future, if we're just in the moment, you know, life is generally pretty good. And so a lot of this really comes back to choices. And, mm-hmm. and you'd mentioned it's that connection between the mind and the brain. And if we make the choice to be in the moment with our mind, then that choice is now causing this chemical reaction in our brain. If we're focused on the here and now, we get this sense of peace, this sense of calmness. So we're having these neurotransmitters released that are helping us to calm down. You know, the anger is going away, the stress is going away by being in the moment. So it's something very simple, but inevitably our minds get drawn to, what do I have to do tomorrow? Oh, this happened to me today. You know, I've got all these things. So it's the mind-brain-body connection is just, it's an amazing thing, and we're just barely scratching the surface of what the brain's all about. But if we choose to do those things, and again, that's what I think a coach can help us do, is help us make the choices that are for our own benefit. I think that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, very significant. A great takeaway from all of this for our listeners. We're coming near the top of the hour. I want to thank you for being here, Eric. And before I do that, I want to make sure that everybody has an opportunity one last time, if you'd like to join us for any final comment, at 646-716-9397. Our sponsor for today's program is Audible.com. I've been personally using Audible since 2012, and I have used it to allow me the opportunity to read or to listen audibly, obviously, to several different books that have allowed me to learn how to be a better father, a better husband, and certainly a better coach and better human being. They've contributed to my professional career as a IT director, and certainly to my professional career as a business owner and as a life and leadership coach. So I welcome you to use them. They are also the sponsor for this program, and I'm glad to say that I am a user of theirs, and I hope that you would do the same. You've been listening to Lifelines with Wendell Buckner as we talk about the science of coaching with my friend Eric Reeves. Eric, if you have any last comments that you'd like to make, please just feel free to do that. Tell people how to get in touch with you and how they can hear more from you in the future.
Certainly. And again, Wendell, I want to thank you. This has been a lot of fun, and you've really kind of stretched me to kind of pull from memory all these things that I've been studying over the past couple of years. My contact information is Eric, D-R-I-C, dot N, as in November, dot Reeves, R-E-E-V-E-S, at gmail.com. I do have a company that I'm forming with some other coaching friends. It will be the Bodai Group, Bodai being the Japanese word for enlightened mind. So look at that, look for that in the next couple of months. But any coaches that are interested in some of the research I've been doing on critical reflection, on self-study, be happy to help. Send me an email. We'll connect. And, thanks again. Good luck to everybody out there. And, Wendell, hope to see you again soon.
Certainly. This is Wendell Buckner. I am the CEO and founder of Lace for Life Coaching and Consulting, LLC. I focus on leadership, accountability, character, and excellence in coaching for life and for professional leadership. I can be reached at wcbuckner@laceforlife.com. You can visit my website, which is www.laceforlife.com, laceforlife.com. Or you can reach me via phone at 240-507-5223. I hope you've enjoyed our conversation with Eric Reeves and our discussion of science as it relates to coaching. This is Lifelines with Wendell Buckner. I look forward to hearing from you on our next episode. Thank you and good night.